She led the way down a series of short hallways to the conference room where my TAC team had run into the trigger-happy terrorists. The same room where Javad had first attacked me during the raid. The big blue case was gone and the bullet-riddled conference table had been replaced with some generic government desks and computer workstations. A flat-panel TV screen filled a good portion of one wall. Decor change notwithstanding, the room gave me a serious case of the creeps. I could still feel the bruise on my forearm where Javad had bitten me, and there but for the grace of Kevlar. The woman nodded toward a wheeled office chair in one corner.
"Please have a seat. Mr. Church will be with you in—"
"Who are you?" I interrupted. She gave me a three count before she said,
"Major Grace Cortland."
"Major?" I asked. "SAS?" That got the tiniest flicker. A microsecond's widening of her eyes, but she recovered fast.
"Make yourself comfortable, Detective Ledger," she said, and left.
I turned in a slow circle and took in the room. Looked for and found the three micro-cameras. They looked expensive and of a kind I hadn't seen before. I'd bet a year's pay the Church was sitting in another room watching me. I was tempted to scratch my balls. This whole thing was bringing out the screw-you 15-year-old in me, and I had to watch that. Give in to any kind of pettiness and you lose your edge real damn fast. So instead I strolled the room and learned what I could, even with Cookie Monster watching. There was a second and much heavier door at the far end of the room that looked brand new. I remembered it being a regular office door before, and when I inspected it, I could see the recent carpentry and smell the fresh paint. I tapped it. Wood veneer over steel, and it was dollars to donuts that the wall had been reinforced too. I heard the door behind me open, and I turned as Mr. Church entered with the British woman behind him. He was dressed in a charcoal suit, polished shoes, and the same tinted glasses. He made no comment about my investigation of the room. He just pulled up a chair and sat. Major Cortland remained standing, her face a study in disapproval. I took a step toward him. "Where the fuck is Dr. Sanchez?" He brushed lint from his tie. If he was threatened by me in any way, he did a workmanlike job of not showing it. Cortland shifted to a flanking position with her hands folded across her stomach, perfectly positioned to make a fast grab for her pistol.
"Do you know why you're here, Mr. Ledger?"
"I can make a few guesses," I said, "but you can go stick them up your ass. Where is Rudy Sanchez?" Church's mouth twitched in what I think was an attempt not to smile. He said,
"Grace?"
Cortland walked over to the wall with the TV screen and hit a button. A picture popped on at once, and it showed an office with a desk and a chair. A man sat on the chair with his hands cuffed behind him and a blindfold around his eyes. Rudy. A second man stood behind him. He held a pistol barrel against the back of my friend's head. Rage was a howling thing in my head, and my heart was throbbing in my throat like it was trying to escape. It took everything I had to stand there and hold my tongue. After a moment, Church said,
"Tell me why I shouldn't have the sergeant put two in the back of Dr. Sanchez's head."
I forced myself to turn away from the screen. "He dies, you die," I said.
"Yawn," he said. "Try again."
"What good would it do you or your organization to kill him? He's an innocent. He's a civilian."
"He stopped being a civilian when you told him about the DMS and about our patient Zero. You put that gun to his head, Mr. Ledger."
"That's a crock of shit, and you know it. 9/11 may have wrinkled the Constitution, but it didn't run it through a shredder." Church spread his hands.
"I repeat my question. Tell me why I shouldn't have Sergeant Dietrich shoot Dr. Sanchez. We're a secret organization, and we're playing for the highest possible stakes. Nothing. Not even the Bill of Rights matters more than what we're doing, and that is in no way an exaggeration."
I said nothing.
Mr. Ledger, if terrorists had a truck filled with suitcase nukes, and one of them went off, in each of 20 cities around the country, it would do less damage to America as a whole and to its people than if another carrier like Javad got out into the population. If a plague of this kind starts, we could not stop it. The infection rate and aggression factor would make it uncontrollable within minutes.
He chewed his gum for a minute and then repeated that.
Minutes. I held my tongue. If we cannot count on your complete loyalty and complete cooperation, you are worthless to us. You would be useless to me.
Even behind his tinted glasses, I could feel the impact of his stare.
What is it you want?
Time is very short, so this is the deal, Mr. Ledger. We have a need to put a new tactical team into operation ASAP. Ordinary military and even our standard special forces units are not appropriate for this for reasons we can discuss later. Major Cortland already has one team at operational readiness. Our other team is on the West Coast involved in something of nearly equal importance. One local team isn't enough. I need a third team. I need it to be tight, and I need it yesterday. I also need someone to lead that team into the field. I've narrowed the list of possibilities down to 6 candidates, 5 others, and you.
Hooray for me. What does this have to do with Rudy Sanchez?
I want you to give me your word that you will join us and become one of us, not some reckless outsider. You are either DMS or you're not.
Or what? You'll kill Rudy?
Church jerked his head toward Cortland. She punched a button on the wall.
Gus, uncuff Dr. Sanchez, bring him a sandwich and keep him company.
She turned off the monitor. I turned back to Church.
Why all the friggin' drama?
To make a point. If I'd had more time to be dramatic, I'd have had your father, your brother, and his wife, your nephew, and even your cat in here.
I'm a short step away from popping a cap in you, I said.
He leaned close.
I don't care. Dr. Sanchez is here because you made a breach of security. How we'll handle that is another matter. Right now, we need to stop playing ping-pong here and get to the point. Then damn well get to it.
I told you what I need. A team leader. He nodded.
I need to start training the new team today, because if we're really lucky, Mr. Ledger, that team may have to go into the field within days, maybe within hours. I don't have time to coax you or stroke your ego or appeal to your patriotism.
So, what? You wanted to make me afraid?
An apocalypse is an abstract and unreal concept. The sudden loss of everyone you love and care about is not. Time is not our friend.
You're saying that there are more of these Walker things, aren't you?
Yes.
Even though I expected that answer, it was like a punch in the mouth.
He said, "We haven't stopped this thing yet, Mr. Ledger. At best, we slowed it down by a few days."
You should have figured that out before. It's the logical.
We did figure it out. But we had nowhere to go with the supposition. Our codebreakers have been working round the clock to determine the location of any cells connected to the one you took down. We know where one is because of the truck the task force tailed. We have not risked hitting that site because there may be more sites, and we don't want to panic these people. Play it wrong, and they could go dark and we'd lose the trail. Or they could release the plague right away. We've recovered enough information to make us reasonably sure they are sticking to a prearranged deadline, so we don't want to hurry that along. Because we did not intercept that truck and did not raid the place to which it went, we're trying to make them believe they've given us the slip. The raid, after all, was half a day after the truck left.
Trucks, I corrected. There were 2,
We tailed one and lost one.
Too bloody right you did, muttered Cortland, and I gave her a hard look to which she merely cocked a challenging eyebrow.
So, why the urgency to train a hit team if you're not about to make a hit?
I didn't say that.
It's my intention to have a team covertly infiltrate the one facility we have under surveillance.
Infiltrate to what end?
To locate other cells or to find more walkers?
Either will do.
I swallowed a dry throat.
What makes you think that the other hypothetical cells will still be in place?
Once this cell here at this warehouse went dark, the others would probably have followed a protocol of some kind.
Very likely, Major Cortland cut in. But we have to go forward with what leads we have. On the upside, however, the other facility shows no signs of activity, no rats fleeing, so maybe they think they're clear. In the absence of more intelligence, a quiet infiltration is our safest option.
I frowned. And with all the military special ops and guys like SWAT and HRT, you want to form a new team? There are guys out there with years more experience than me. Does the name Delta Force ring any bells with you people?
It's more complicated than that, Church said. He gestured toward the far door, the one with the heavy scanner. The other potential team leaders are in the adjoining room. Each of them is tough, experienced, and aware of the threat. All of them are active military. Two Rangers, one Navy, one Marine Force Recon, and yes, even one from Delta Force. All of them have more combat and tactical experience than you do. Though, admittedly, you bring other qualities to the game. You're all unique in one way or another, but we don't have time to discuss that at the moment. I need to get the team leader status sorted out right now.
What do you want us to do, play rock, paper, scissors to see who gets the job?
Grace, he said, and she went over to the heavy-duty door and unlocked it.
If you'll come this way, detective.
I stood up slowly. This is a lot of James Bond bullshit to decide a human resources issue, isn't it? Church remained seated. He nodded his head toward the doorway, so I walked over and peered inside. Five guys in civilian clothes, three sitting and two standing. All of them looked tough, and all of them looked either confused or pissed off. They seemed frozen in an agitated tableau as if the door opening had interrupted them in the middle of a heated debate. I turned back to Church. You still haven't told me how you want us to sort this out. He made that face again that might have been a smile. I've seen the big hunting cats make that same kind of face.
Think outside the box, Mr. Ledger.
Okay, I said, but you have to pick up the tab afterward. He gave me a single short nod. I stepped into the room. All of the men were looking me up and down, a couple of them giving me evil stares that would have scared the paint off a tank. Cortland left and pulled the door closed behind her. I heard the heavy lock engage.
Chapter 25. Galt, the Hotel Ishtar, Baghdad, 5 days ago. Galt was on the road moving in a roundabout way from Amira's bunker in the Helmand province of Afghanistan across the border to Iran, where he changed identities 3 times in 14 hours, and then entered a safe house run by a client of a client, where he ate, made some calls, and then changed identities again, back to Sebastian Galt. Galt was welcome in Iran and most other countries because his company was one of the world's top suppliers of pharmaceuticals for humanitarian aid. He traveled with 3 kind-hearted but clueless members of the World Health Organization as they visited remote villages in western Iran where a TB outbreak had been reported. Galt did a few stand-ups for a Swiss news service about the need for swift action in stemming the spread of the new strain of TB, and then thanked the Iranian government for allowing free passage for the WHO doctors. When he crossed the border into Iraq, he was met by a military escort of British soldiers who got him safely all the way to Baghdad. Toys met him in the lobby and they shook hands.
"I trust you had a comfortable trip," said his personal assistant, taking Galt's bag and leading him to the elevator.
As they crossed the lobby, they were both aware that everyone was looking at them. Toys was not a tall man, but he had tall energy. He was slender, fit, and had impeccable posture. And he always managed to look cool and well-groomed, no matter where they were. Galt had seen him ankle-deep in the mosquito swamps of Kenya, looking as collected as if he were at a cocktail party at Cannes. But to anyone watching, it was immediately clear which of them was the Alpha. Galt was taller, more physically imposing, with swept-back hair and piercing dark eyes. He was ruggedly handsome, where Toys was delicately so. By himself, Toys could command almost any room, but his light dimmed considerably in Galt's presence. Galt knew this, and so did Toys. They were both comfortable with the arrangement. They chit-chatted on the lift, talking of relatively unimportant Gen 2000 matters. Once they were in the suite of rooms they shared at the Hotel Ishtar, Toys swept the place with the newest generation of interceptor surveillance sensors, and everything came up clean. Even so, they avoided any sensitive topics for an hour, at which point Toys swept it again, knowing that surveillance teams often deactivate active listening in the first few minutes after someone checks into a hotel, knowing that a smart spy would sweep the room. They typically reactivate their bugs in 40 minutes, so he gave it a full hour. It still came up clean. Toys busied himself with unpacking while Galt took a hot bath. Later, with Galt snugged into a bathrobe and ensconced in a cushy armchair, a tall gin and tonic quietly melting on a nearby table, Toys settled down onto a more decorative faux Louis XIV chair, legs crossed, rolling a neat whiskey between his palms.
"You got a text message while you were in the bath," Toys said primly. "Just one word. Clean." "That's from L. Musclehead?"
Galt smiled and nodded.
"His team field-tested an entirely new generation of the Saif al-Din today. That was the code to let me know the operation was successful." He gave Toys the details.
"That's disgusting," Toys said, but if he had any real emotional reaction to the slaughter, not one drop of it registered on his face.
"It's a solid step forward," Galt reminded him.
With a waspish sniff, Toys said, "So, tell me about the happy couple."
Galt told him everything, including his observations of the telltale clues in Amira's voice and facial expression. Toys listened without interruption, but when Galt was done, he shook his head.
"I think she's been stuck too long in that bunker with all her toys making monsters. She's probably halfway to being a monster herself by now. Are you sure she shares your goals?"
Galt shrugged. There was a time, early in their affair, when he thought that he and Amira would become some kind of king and queen of the economic world. His plan would clearly work, was working already, and he estimated that, at the very least, his various companies would net something like 20 to 30 billion. Best-case scenario hovered deliciously around the 100 billion mark. He could conceivably become the richest man on Earth. But so much of that hinged on Amira staying within the confines of the operation. When it was clear Galt was not going to answer, Toys tossed back the rest of his drink and got up to make a fresh one. The phone rang and Toys answered.
"I've been trying to reach your boss all day," snapped the American. "Is the line clear?"
"What do you think?" Toys asked.
"Hold on. He's right here."
He handed the phone across to Galt.
"What can I do for you?"
Galt said. Toys leaned in close to eavesdrop.
"This morning the heads of all the special operations divisions were given a briefing by the head of this new geek squad."
"Ah, so, who's running it?"
"That's the weird part. We received certain documents ostensibly from the head of this new branch, but on several of them the name of the person in charge was different. Some identified him as Mr. Elder, Mr. St. John, Mr. Deacon, and Mr. Church. Now, whether these refer to the same man or for section heads is unknown, but I got the impression they were code names for one guy, the one who was giving us our briefing. He was introduced to us as Mr. Pope,
I have some careful feelers out there, and I should be able to lock it down.
That fits with what Toys has been able to dig up, Galt said. What interests me is whether you've been able to get a man inside, as I asked.
Yeah, said the American. I have.
Chapter 26. Baltimore, Maryland, Tuesday, June 30th, 2:42 p.m. I stood by the door and looked them over. My nerves were still jangling from seeing that gun against Rudy's head, and I don't know whether I believed Church would have killed him or not. I felt like there was this gigantic, Big Ben-sized clock ticking right over my head. The room was mostly bare except for a few folding chairs and a card table on which was an open case of bottled water, a tray of sandwich meats and cheeses, and an opened loaf of white bread. Apparently, the DMS budget didn't extend to decent catering. The guy closest to me, standing to my left, was maybe 6 feet, but he must have been 240, and all of it was in his chest and shoulders. His face had a vaguely simian cast to it. Next to Ape Man was a taller, leaner guy with a beaky nose and a long scar that ran from his hairline through his right eyebrow and halfway down his cheek. Opposite Scarface was a black guy who looked like every Army top sergeant you ever saw. Buzz cut, a boxer's broken nose, and a lantern jaw. Behind Sergeant Rock was a red-haired kid in his early 20s who had a jovial face. In fact, he was the only guy smiling in the room. To the Joker's right was a real moose of a guy, easily 6'6", with ropey muscles and heavily scarred hands. Jolly Green Giant was the first to speak.
Looks like we got another candidate.
I walked into the center of the group. Scarface grunted.
Make yourself comfortable. We've been in here for almost 3 hours trying to sort out which one of us should head this team.
Really? I said, and kicked him in the balls. He let out a thin, whistling shriek of pain that I ignored as I grabbed the shoulder of his windbreaker and jerked him hard and fast so that he collided with Ape Man and they both went down. I spun off that and stomped down on the Joker's foot and then pivoted to bring the same foot up again, heel first into his nuts. He didn't scream, but he hissed real loud, and I nailed Sergeant Rock with a palm shot to the chest that sent him sprawling onto the food table, which collapsed under him. That left Jolly Green Giant standing, and he gaped at me in shock for maybe a half second before he started to swing, but that was a half second too long, and I darted forward and drove the extended secondary index finger knuckle of my right hand into his left sinus, right next to his nose, giving it a fast counterclockwise twist on impact. He went back like he'd taken a 45 round in the face. I pivoted again to see Ape Man pushing his way out from under Scarface, but he was only halfway to his feet, and I swept his supporting leg out from under him, and he fell hard on his tailbone, almost, but not quite, catching himself by planting his hand flat on the ground. I stamped on his outstretched fingers and then chop-kicked him in the chest before spinning off to face Sergeant Rock, who had come up off the collapsed card table with an impressive display of rubbery agility. The other four guys were down, and it was just him and me. He held his hands up, and I knew that I wouldn't be able to sucker him again, but then he smiled and turned his karate guard into a palms out. Not a surrender so much as an acknowledgement of set and match. I gave him a nod and stepped back, and edged away from the other four. Two of them were down for the count. Jolly Green Giant was sitting in the corner holding his face. If he had any kind of sinus issues, that punch I gave him would likely become a migraine. Scarface was lying on the floor in a fetal position, hands cupped around his balls, groaning. The Joker was getting to his feet, but he had no fight left in him. Ape Man was sitting against a wall, trying to suck in a breath. I heard the door click open, and I stepped to one side as I turned, outside of everyone's reach. Church and Cortland came in. He was smiling. She wasn't.
"Gentlemen," he said quietly, "I want you to meet Joe Ledger, the DMS's new team leader. Any questions?"
Chapter 27. Baltimore, Maryland, Tuesday, June 30th, 2:43 p.m.
"How long did this take, Grace?" Church asked.
4.6 seconds
It sounded like the words were pulled out of her with pliers. Or 8.7, if you count from close of door. The other candidates stared at Church and at me, and one of them, Ape Man, looked like he was going to say something, but he caught some look from Church and held his tongue and glared. There was not a whole lot of love in the room.
Get up, Church said to them. His voice wasn't bitter or harsh, merely quiet.
Sometimes quiet is worse. And I watched the faces of each man as they climbed to their feet. Jolly Green Giant and Sergeant Rock showed no trace of animosity on their faces, and the latter even looked amused. Joker's face was cautious, guarded. Scarface looked equal parts deeply embarrassed and angry. Ape Man stared hot death at me as he stood up. He rubbed his chest and gave me a sniper's squint. My hands were shaking, but adrenaline will do that. Plus the image of Rudy with a gun to his head wouldn't leave my mind.
I want to see Rudy, I said.
Now.
Church shook his head. No, there are other things you need to do first.
He'd better be okay, he smiled.
Dr. Sanchez is currently eating his way through an entire catering platter and probably psychoanalyzing Sergeant Dietrich's rather complicated childhood. He's fine and he can wait.
No one said anything. Okay, I said, surprised at how calm my voice sounded. So now what do we do?
Major Cortland will bring you up to speed. The entire staff will meet in the main hall in 30 minutes.
He paused and then held out his hand.
Welcome aboard, Mr. Ledger.
I don't mean to offend you two, I said, taking his hand. But you're both total assholes. I gave his hand my best squeeze, and damn if the son of a bitch didn't match me pound for pound.
I'll cry about that later, Church said.
We let go of each other, and I folded my arms. If I'm going to be team leader, where's the actual team?
You just kicked the effing hell out of them, Cortland said.
I turned and looked at the five men.
Oh, crap.
I've worked with street thugs, murderers, and the worst kind of lowlifes for years, and have knocked in their heads, shot them, tasered them, and sent them to prison for life. But none of them ever gave me the kinds of looks I was getting from my team. If they'd had a tree limb and a rope, I'd be swinging in the wind. I thought I heard Church give a quiet chuckle as he turned and left. Maybe this was the moment where I was supposed to make some kind of speech, but before I could say anything, Cortland beat me to it.
"Get cleaned up," she snapped. "Ledger, come with me," she started for the door.
I started to follow her but sensed movement and turned to see Ape Man coming toward me. His face was purple with rage, hands balled into white-knuckled fists.
"You suckered me, asshole, and first chance I get I'm gonna wipe the floor up with you."
"No," I said, "you're not," and I punched him in the throat. I stepped out of the way as he fell. The room was dead silent, and I deliberately turned my back on the other four as I said to Cortland, "I hope to hell you have a medic here, 'cause he's going to need one." Chapter 28 Sebastian Galt, the Hotel Ishtar, Baghdad, 5 days ago.
Line?
Clear, said the fighter.
What have you to report, my friend?
Galt was chin-deep in a tub of soapy water, the Goldberg variations playing quietly on the CD player. The young woman in the other room was asleep. Knowing this call was coming in, Toys had slipped something into her drink before escorting her to Galt's room. She'd sleep for 4 more hours and wake up without feeling any adverse effects. It was useful being a chemist and having an assistant without a conscience.
El Mujahid said, "Everything in place."
"Jolly good. Once you complete the first stage, my lads in the Red Cross will make sure the correct transfers take place. With any luck, you should be on a hospital ship heading out of the Gulf by midnight."
"Sebastian," said El Mujahid.
"Yes?" "I'm putting a lot of trust in you. I expect you to hold up your end of things."
"My hand to Allah,"
Galt said as he used his toes to turn on the hot water tap.
"You can certainly trust me.
Everything will go smoothly.
There was a short silence at the other end of the line, and then the fighter said,
Tell my wife I love her.
Galt smiled up at the ceiling.
Of course I will, my old friend.
Go with God. He clicked off and tossed the phone onto the closed lid of the toilet. He was laughing when he did it. Chapter 29. Baltimore, Maryland, Tuesday, June 30th, 2:46 p.m. After Major Cortland called in the medical team, she joined me in the hallway, and I could tell she was reevaluating me. Her eyes roved over my face like a scanner, and I could almost hear the relays click in her head. Across the hall was a men's room, and I started toward it, but she stopped me with a touch on my arm.
Ledger, what made you think Mr. Church wanted you to do that?
I shrugged. He said time was short.
That's not the same thing as telling you to go in there and start kicking everyone's ass.
You have a problem with it? She smiled again. A nice smile. It transformed her from a cobra to something a hell of a lot more appealing, an actual human being.
Not at all. As much as I hate to say it, I'm rather impressed.
Hate to say it? I echoed.
You are a very hard person to like, Mr. Ledger.
Call me Joe, and no, I'm not. Lots of people like me. She didn't comment on that.
Let me put it another way. You're a very hard man to trust, especially in an operation of this kind.
Grace, may I call you Grace?
You may call me Major Cortland.
Okay, Major Cortland, I said. It isn't my goal in life to get you to trust me. You jokers pulled me into this. I didn't submit a resume. I'm not military. So if you have issues about trust or anything else up to and including liking me, then seriously, please go and screw yourself, Major. She blinked once. I did not and do not want my life tied up in cloak and dagger bullshit, dead guys, or pissing contests with either the testosterone crowd in there or some prissy-assed, Earl Grey-drinking, scone-munching major who isn't even my freaking boss. I don't know you, and I don't give a rat's ass if you trust me.
Mr. Ledger,
I have to take a piss. I headed down the hall to the bathroom. I used the toilet and then washed my face first with hot water and then cold, dabbed it dry with a fistful of paper towels, and then leaned on the edge of the sink, staring at my face in the mirror. My skin was flushed and my eyes had the jumpy look you usually see in junkies. My hair stuck out in all directions. Well, I said to my reflection, aren't you a picture? I didn't have a comb, so I used wet fingers to plaster down my hair, and as I stood there, the full weight and enormity of what was going on hit me like a freight train. I bowed over the sink, tasting bile, ready to throw up, but my trembling stomach held. I raised my head again and looked into my eyes and saw fear in there. The naked realization of what all this meant. There were more of them out there, more walkers. And I was being asked to step up and be, what, some kind of Captain Heroism who would lead the boys in the red, white, and blue to victory? What was I getting myself into? This wasn't task force duty. This wasn't even SWAT team level. I'd never even smelled anything this big before, and now I was expected to train and lead a black ops team? How frigging insane was this? Why were they asking me? I'm just a cop. Where are the guys who actually do this for a living? How come none of them were here? Where's James Bond and Jack Bauer? Why me, of all people? My reflection stared back, looking dazed and a little stupid. Working the task force had not prepared me for this. After 18 months of that, and the years since the World Trade Center, I'd come to share the more or less common view that the terrorists had fired their worst shots and were now hiding in caves and reevaluating the wisdom of having overplayed their hand. Now Church tells me that they hold the key to a global pandemic. By raising the actual dead?
God almighty.
Flying planes into buildings is bad enough. Chemical weapons, anthrax, nerve gas, suicide bombers, that stuff has collectively been the definition of terrorism to the global consciousness for years, and that's been more than bad enough. This was so much worse, I didn't know if I could put it into any reasonable perspective. If they were trying to spread Ebola, it wouldn't be this bad because Ebola doesn't chase and try to bite you. Whoever was behind this was one sick son of a bitch. Smart, sure, but sick. This went beyond religious fundamentalism or political extremism. Right at that moment, I was sure we were looking at something born out of a mind that was truly and genuinely evil. I don't think I clearly understood Church until that moment. If I were in his place looking into that same future, how would I handle it? How ruthless would I be? How ruthless could I be? I think you already answered that question, boyo, I murmured, thinking about the five men in that room. Church may act like a Vulcan, but he had to be feeling all this stuff, too. If so, then the strain of holding back all of his emotions, all of his humanity, must be terrible. If I were going to work for him, then I'd have to look for signs of that pressure, look for cracks. Not only in me, but in him, too. On the other hand, Church could be a monster himself, just one on our side. There were guys like that. Hell, after World War II, our own government hired a bunch of Nazi scientists. Better the devil you know. More to the point, there was the comment FDR supposedly made about Somoza, something like, he's a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. Great. I'm going to work for a monster in order to fight other monsters, so what did that make me? The bathroom floor seemed to tilt a bit as I headed for the door.
Chapter 30 El Mujahid, near Najaf, Iraq, 5 days ago.
"We're coming," said Abdul, El Mujahid's lieutenant. 2 British Apache attack helicopters, 4 minutes.
"Excellent," the fighter murmured. He took one last look around and then handed a bundle of clothes to Abdul. "There is nothing of value here. Burn them."
The half-track sat askew in the middle of an intersection of 2 lonely roads, 36 kilometers from Najaf. Smoke still curled up from beneath the chassis. Additional smoke rose from 12 corpses. There was blood everywhere, muted by sand to the color of dusty roses. 2 cars were in flames, an old Ford Falcon and a Chinese Benben, both with registration numbers that would tie them to jihadist sympathizers. The entire picture was perfect. A battle fought to a tragic victory. A half-track crippled by a roadside bomb. A few British soldiers, outnumbered by insurgents, taking heavy casualties as they bravely fought through an ambush. All of the hostiles dead. Of the 7 Brits in the truck, 4 were dead, badly mangled and burned, and 3 clung to life.
"Go, go, go,"
whispered El Mujahid, and his lieutenant melted away and slipped down into a rat hole hidden by a spring trapdoor covered with coarse dry bushes. In the stillness, nothing moved, and the only sound apart from the whoop-whoop-whoop of the helo rotors were the piteous moans of the wounded.
"Allahu Akbar,"
said El Mujahid, and then used his thumb to test the edge of the piece of jagged metal debris he had selected. He laced the tip of the metal against his forehead, right at the hairline. He drew a breath, held it, and then exhaled sharply as he ripped the metal through his skin, tearing down from upper left to lower right, through his eyebrow, across the bridge of his nose, along his cheek, all the way to his jawline. Pain exploded in his face and blood surged from the cut. He could feel tears in his eyes, and he had to bite down against the white-hot agony of the wound. It was worse, far worse than he expected, and it nearly tore the cry from his throat. The helicopters were nearly overhead.
With a gasp, he flung the metal from him and slumped back into the wreckage, deliberately snorting blood out of his nose and mouth, making sure that the droplets touched everything. By the time the first helicopter landed, he was perfectly placed, his torn face transformed into a mask of bright blood, his clothing soaked. His heart raced, and he could feel blood flow from the wound with each pulse beat. He closed his eyes, and as he heard the first footfalls as the soldiers leaped from the helicopter, he raised one gory hand and reached toward them, and now he let out the scream. It was a wet, gargling cry, inarticulate and savagely hurt.
"Here!"
he heard a voice yell, and then the half-track rocked as men clambered inside. There were hands on him, touching him, probing him, feeling for his pulse.
"This one's alive. Get the medics."
Fingers scrabbled around his throat, feeling for the little dog tag chain, pulling it free.
"Sergeant Henderson," a voice said, reading the name. 103rd Armored.
"Clear the way. Let me get to him,"
said a different voice, and then there was a compress against his face as the medics worked to save the lives of the British wounded. It took every ounce of strength that the fighter possessed not to smile. Chapter 31. Baltimore, Maryland, Tuesday, June 30th, 2:51 p.m. We were in Cortland's office, just the two of us. Everything was still not unpacked, and I had to sit on a plastic folding chair. We were both drinking bottled spring water. One wall of the office was a big picture window that looked out onto the harbor. The afternoon sunshine made everything look peaceful, but the lie buried within the illusion was appalling. I turned away from the window and looked at Cortland.
"I'd prefer to have given you the complete version of this, but as Mr. Church pointed out, we don't have the time, so the learning curve will be more of a straight line."
She sat back and crossed her legs. Even in the fatigue pants, I could tell she had nice legs. Except for her personality, which so far was somewhere between a cranky alligator and a defensive moray eel, most things about her were nice. I even liked her husky voice and thick British accent. I just didn't particularly like her.
"Fire away," I said.
"After 9/11, your government formed Homeland Security, and Great Britain created a similar and rather more secret organization, codename of Barrier. You won't have heard of it. MI5 and MI6 get most of the press, which is as it should be. Barrier was given a lot of power and freedom of action, and was therefore able to stop several major threats against my country that would have been to us as devastating as the World Trade Center attack was on you. As I was involved in some of those operations, I was loaned out to your government when the DMS was formed."
"Did you help create the DMS?"
"No," she said. "That was Mr. Church's doing. But there were some similarities in both structure and agenda between the DMS and Barrier and the lines of communication, at least where anti-terrorism is concerned, are wide open between the White House and Whitehall. As you probably know, there are many such task forces around the country, and all of their intel passes in one way or another through DMS hands. Church is wired in everywhere. When your wiretap flagged the name El Mujahid, it rang a bell at the DMS, and Church ordered an immediate infiltration of the task force. By the time the team was formed, we had three agents in place."
"Really? Then you do have a working field team."
"Did," she said as a shadow passed across her face. "But we'll get to that. First, I need to tell you about the cell your task force took down. After the raid, our computer specialists were able to salvage several laptops, and we've been systematically decrypting their coded records. We haven't learned as much as we'd like, but we are making some headway. So far, we've decoded what amounts to shipping manifests for weapons, medical supplies, research equipment, and even human cargo."
"You mean agents they've smuggled in?" She shook her head.
"No. Actual human cargo, like Javad. Brought into this country in temperature-controlled containers like the one you found here."
"How many others?"
"We've only found references to three, including Javad."
"Shit," I said.
The import records indicate that the other walkers were brought into the country less than 24 hours before your task force raided the place. The other two must have been shipped out late the previous day. And there's a high probability they were in those two lorries.
That's why you took all of the files from the task force, isn't it? You wanted the surveillance logs for traffic in and out of this place, and you want all of it off the record.
Again, she gave me that appraising look, as if her idiot nephew had learned to tie his own shoelaces.
Yes, she admitted. So, where did the other containers go?
It took her a few seconds to decide whether to tell me.
Look, Major, I said, either you level with me on everything or we're done here. I don't know why you have a bug up your ass about me, and frankly, I don't care, but you are wasting my time hemming and hawing.
I started to get to my feet, but she waved me back down.
All right, she snapped. Sit down, damn it.
She opened a folder, removed a sheet of paper, and slapped it down on the desk.
This is the log for the night before the raid. Two lorries left the warehouse lot, one 8 minutes after midnight, the other at 03:30. Task force agents were assigned to follow both and report their destinations. One was tracked to a crab processing plant near Crisfield, Maryland. The other was lost in traffic.
She stabbed an entry with a forefinger.
You were tailing the one that got lost in traffic.
I plucked the paper off the desk, glanced at it, and then tossed it down.
Good God, Major. If this is any indication of the precision of your intel, then I'm going to grab my loved ones and make a run for the hills.
You're denying that you were assigned to the tail?
No, I was definitely assigned to tail the truck, Major, but I didn't do that tail. 4 blocks into the follow, I was pulled and replaced by another officer. My lieutenant called on the task force's secure channel and had me report back to the surveillance van because there was more cell phone chatter and I was the only guy on shift who understands Farsi. I spent 20 minutes listening to one of the hostiles talk to an Iraqi woman living in Philadelphia. Mostly they talked about blowjobs and how much he wished she'd give him one. Really cutting-edge espionage stuff. You can believe me when I tell you, sister, that when I tail someone, I don't lose them.
She leaned back in her chair and we stared at each other like a pair of gunslingers for maybe 10-15 seconds. There were a lot of ways she could have handled her response, and what she said would probably set the tone for whatever professional relationship we were going to have.
Bloody hell, she said with a sigh. Will you accept my apology?
Will you stop trying to frighten me to death with your icy glare? Her smile was tentative at first, still caught on some of the thorns of her earlier misconceptions. But then it blossomed, full and radiant. She stood up and reached across the desk.
Truce, she said.
I stood and took her hand, which was small, warm, and strong.
We have enough enemies, Major. It's better if we're at each other's backs rather than each other's throats.
She gave my hand a little squeeze, then let it go and sat back down.
That's very gracious of you.
She cleared her throat.
Since we, lost that one lorry, we have an investigative operation going to locate it. That's a major priority.
I said, what do we know of the cell itself?
Bits and pieces. We know that they are using a higher level of technology than we've seen before from the terrorist community, and it's just this sort of thing that justifies the existence of the DMS. Understand, the DMS was proposed at the same time as Homeland, but was rejected as being too expensive and unnecessary, the belief at that time being that terrorists may be capable of hijacking planes, but were incapable of constructing advanced bioweapons.
She sounded disgusted.
It's racist thinking, of course. To a very great degree, the moguls in London and Washington still think that everyone in the Middle East is undereducated and out of touch with the 21st century.
Which is bullshit, I said.
Which is bullshit, she agreed. What changed their thinking was something called Mind Reader, which is a piece of software that Mr. Church either procured or invented. I don't know which, and he won't tell me.
Point is that Mind Reader is a cascading analysis package that no other agency has, not even Barrier or Homeland. It looks for patterns through covert links to all intelligence-gathering databases. The tricky part is taking into account different operating systems, different languages, both computer and human, different cultures, time zones, currency rates, units of measure, routes of transport, and so on. Mind Reader cuts through all that. It's also what we're using to try and decrypt the damaged files.
Nice toy.
Indeed. We began to see indications of the acquisition of materials, equipment, and personnel, suggesting the creation of a bioweapons laboratory of considerable sophistication, a lab capable of both creating and weaponizing a biological agent. I thought those materials were monitored. How'd they swing all that?
She gave me a calculating look.
How would you have done it?
What country are we talking?
Terrorism is an ideology, not a nationality. Let's say you're a small group living undercover in a Middle Eastern country, not necessarily with the blessing of your resident state. Your group is composed of separatists from a number of the more extreme factions.
I thought about it.
Okay.
First, I'd have to know that most of what I would need for a conventional bioweapon would be on that list of monitored items. I can't go to the corner drugstore and buy a vial of anthrax. I'd need to buy my materials in small quantities through several layers of middlemen so that no red flags go up. That takes time, and it's expensive. Secrecy has to be bought. I'd buy some stuff in one country, other stuff elsewhere, spreading it around. I'd buy used stuff if I could, or buy parts piecemeal and assemble them, especially hardware. I'd have them shipped to different ports, places where the watchdogs aren't as alert, and then go through some dummy corporations to reship them and reship them again, so this would take both time and money. She gave me an approving smile.
Keep going.
I'd need lab space, testing facilities, production floor, preferably some place where I could dig in. Stuff like this isn't pick up and carry, so I don't want to work on the run. I need a nest. Once I'm set and I've spent whatever time it takes to make my weapon, I'd have to sort out the problem of getting my weapon from my lab to the intended target. And if we're doing advanced medical stuff like plagues and new kinds of parasites, like the crap we're dealing with here, then that's harder because you need access to supercomputers, ultra-sterile lab conditions, and a lot of medical equipment.
Spot on, Cortland said. Mr. Church would probably give you a biscuit for that assessment. Mind Reader caught a whiff of biological research equipment being bought, as you say, piecemeal. Very carefully, you understand, and in small quantities to avoid ringing the kinds of alarms that have in fact been rung. It took a while for any of this to be noticed, because it wasn't precisely the sort of thing we were expecting to find, and without Mind Reader, we would never have spotted it at all. These materials were being ordered by firms located within nations that had been hit by crop blight, livestock disease, or other similar natural calamity. Anyone who didn't have a suspicious mind would think that these countries were scrambling to find cures for the diseases that were creating famine and starvation affecting their own people.
Like mad cow disease, I suggested.
Top marks. Except for India and a handful of others, virtually every nation on Earth depends on beef production, and that disease was responsible for millions of cattle deaths and billions of pounds of economic loss. It would be natural for such countries to do anything they could to find a cure.
Seems to me that you guys should have hit that plant already. I saw her eyes shift away for a moment. If the DMS has a combat team, then they should have been deployed. You keep dodging my questions about what happened to the rest of your team, Major.
They died, Mr. Ledger.
It was Church's voice, and damn if I didn't hear him approach. Few people can sneak up on me. I turned quickly to see Church standing in the doorway, his face dour. He came into the room and leaned against the wall by the window.
Died how?
Cortland looked at Church. But he was looking at me. He said,
Javad.
I killed Javad twice, yes.
But the first time you encountered him, he was still technically alive, infected, sure, dying to be certain, but alive. He was being transported to a hospital for a post-mortem.
Yeah, and he woke up on the way to the morgue.
God.
Cortland said, "The bite of a walker is 100% infectious, so you both said. If a person receives a fatal bite, then shortly after clinical death, the disease reactivates the central nervous system and, to a limited degree, some organ functions, and the victim rises as a new carrier. If a person receives even a mild bite, the infection will kill them in about 70 hours, which at best gives us 3 days to locate any victims and contain them."
"I'm not sure I like the word contain," I said.
"No one will like that word, if it comes to that," Church said.
"Bite victims begin to lose cognitive functions quickly," Cortland continued. "And even before clinical death, they become dissociative, delusional, and uncontrollably aggressive. In both the pre-death and post-reanimation phase, the carriers have a cannibalistic compulsion."
Church said, "This is all information we learned after the fact." I looked at them.
"What the hell happened?"
Church's face was ice. "We didn't know what Javad was at first. How could we? The learning process for us was very awkward."
"What does that mean?"
"You read about the fire at St. Michael's Hospital? The night of the task force hit?"
I sat there not wanting to hear this.
Grace looked away, but Church stared back at me with a dreadful intensity.
"Javad woke up hungry, Mr. Ledger. Only 2 DMS agents accompanied the body to the morgue. We lost contact with them shortly after arrival. Major Cortland and I were actually at the hospital, but were conducting an interview in another wing. When the alert came in, we called in all available teams, but by the time they arrived on the scene, the infection had spread to an entire wing of the hospital. Major Cortland's Alpha team had perimeter duty, and Bravo and Charlie teams entered the hospital to try and contain the situation."
"We thought there had been an attempt by other terrorists to recover the bodies of their fallen comrades," Cortland said. "But it was only Javad. By the time the teams were inside, the infection was completely out of control. Javad had gotten all the way down to the lobby and was attacking people in the waiting area. Mr. Church was able to subdue him, and before you ask, no, we didn't know what Javad was at that point. He was a suspected terrorist, albeit one we thought had been killed. Our agents were confused because the attackers appeared to be patients, doctors, nurses. Our men hesitated. They were overwhelmed."
"How many of them did you lose?"
"All of them, Mr. Ledger," Church said. 2 teams, 22 men and women, plus the 2 agents who had been in the ambulance. Some of the finest and most capable tactical field operatives in the world, torn to pieces by old women, children, ordinary civilians, and ultimately by each other."
"What did you do?"
"You read the newspapers. The situation needed to be contained."
I leaped to my feet. "Jesus Christ! Are you telling me that you deliberately burned down the entire fucking hospital? What kind of a sick son of a bitch are you?"
Without turning, he said, "Earlier, when I told you that if this plague gets out, there will be no way to stop it, I was not exaggerating. Everyone would die, Mr. Ledger. Everyone. We are talking the actual apocalypse here. Counting Javad, our patient zero, we have a loss of life totaling 188 civilians and 24 DMS operatives, 210 deaths as a result of one carrier. Friends of mine are dead. people I knew and trusted, and all of this spread from a single source that was more or less contained. We lucked out in that the attack was inside a building that had reinforced windows and heavy-duty doors we could lock, and to a small degree we were on the alert, though not for something like this. If no security had accompanied